Michael Haynes, could we begin with the speech that rivets me now? It's not so much the I Have a Dream speech, but the mountaintop speech at the very end of Dr. King's life.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
So powerful and so deep into some mystery that he hadn't fully disclosed. What was his dread that night of an early death? He said, longevity isn't everything.
I think his response, he was very cognizant of the fact that his days were numbered. For quite a while, he had been very aware of that. Remember his last trip into Boston before that event, he didn't go to the airport with a whole lot of sirens and a whole lot of police. Just one police car following the car that he was riding in. I was driving him that night. And he knew that there was a price on his head, and he knew his days were numbered, and he wanted to fulfill what God's will was for him on this whole issue of justice.
How did he know there was a price on his head? Who else knew? Why didn't everybody know?
I think many people knew. Many people knew. He had been threatened. His home had been bombed. He had received death notices on a number of occasions. Early in Montgomery, he realized that his life was going to be taken. Very early in Montgomery. So this traveled with him, and he realized it was only a matter of time. He knew this.
He said he'd been to the mountaintop, and he'd seen the promised land.
I would think that he was foreseeing in that the time would come when blacks would be able to move in and through the United States under almost every condition and be accepted as equal and full citizens. I think he would be saying that some of what he saw was what's going on in the nation politically today. A black man running for the presidency of the United States in a competitive way. Previous Shirley Chisholm, the other black candidates, more symbolism. But here, this is a competitive, realistic, possible case. And that's part of the mountaintop, that blacks could move into the highest positions in the United States of America.
He also spoke dramatically of fearing no man, and he was also charging up commercial boycotts in the same moment.
Well, of course, that night he certainly was concerned about boycotts, and he realized out of the Montgomery experience that if you are patient and if you follow a nonviolent approach, you will break the back of the economic structure, as happened in Montgomery with the bus boycott. And so he realized that this was a very, very important tool that was very effective, because the God of this country and the God of the world is money.
Michael Haynes, you started out with Martin Luther King Jr., apprentices at the 12th Baptist Church, sometime preachers, activists. He was a student. You were a youth worker. Is there a way to reintroduce us to that young man, both of you in your 20s? He recently arrived at Boston University from Georgia. You, a native Bostonian. Introduce us to that guy.
One of the very, very interesting things about that relationship, when it's the day when it started. Now, Martin is about a year and 7 months younger than I. But yet he was way ahead of me in so many ways. I think the comparison, number one, he came from a middle class home. His parents had a college education. I came from a home of immigrant parents that with very, very, very limited education, trying to understand the American culture, thinking there was gold here, not realizing there was as much oppression and discrimination as my parents discovered in America, because they came just on the threshold of the Great Depression. And my father and my mother, I think, imagined that this was the next step before heaven, was coming to the United States of America and coming to Boston. Then they found out that such was not the case. They ran into racial discrimination, they ran into poverty, they ran into the Depression, they ran into public welfare, all these things that Martin was able to escape, but he did not escape the rank and the worst of racial discrimination and hatred. And his whole educational process was so different than mine. He was working on a PhD, and I was trying to get a Bachelor of Divinity degree. And one of the interesting things, after the last sermon that he preached in 12th, he had already got married in 1953. He had settled into Montgomery, and he came back up to Boston, finishing up some things between Boston University and here, and there after we were talking. I don't know what issues we were talking about. Somewhere in the course of events, he asked me if I would consider coming to Montgomery, Alabama, as his youth minister.
Really?
And little did I know, my reservation was ML. I've never been below the Mason-Dixon line. I don't know how I would adapt to that way of life in the South. That was my reservation. But I look back on it many times since then, and realized that had I dared to accept that opportunity, I probably would have been an extremely different person. But it had to do with God's divine will and God's revealed providence that I'd be there. Little did I ever think at that time that I was going to end up being the senior minister of 12th Baptist Church. I never foresaw that at that time. But that links in with something else that happened a little later on, in 1964, when I was running for the legislature. Before I made my final decision, Martin was in town one time, and I spoke to him about that. I remember the little talk that he gave me. He says, some of us have to work from the outside, and that's extremely important if we're going to get the mission done. But some of us need to work on the inside. So he encouraged me in my run for the state legislature to work on the inside. And I felt very, very good about that the day when we were able to invite him to address the Massachusetts legislature. That was the first legislative body in the United States that he'd been invited to address. Other legislatures trying to find ways to quiet him and silence him. So he was very, very thrilled at the opportunity of coming to the Massachusetts legislature.
Go back to the early 50s. One of the things that's so interesting to me is that this was pre-movement. It was not a fashionable cause, probably not even in the larger black community, certainly not in the media, in the liberal newspapers and universities. These were strong and rather eccentric young men who had a sense of mission, all of them probably strongly motivated at home. But where did it come from, this confidence about their life work and their when you were still in your early 20s?
I think for any black, north or south, realizing that there's strictures, there's limitations, we're still being kept out, we're still being separated, and there's something grossly wrong with the separation, and these walls, these barriers need to be broken down. And I think a lot of young leaders, probably including myself, were just waiting for God to appoint a Moses. The time was just right, and Martin was that man that was going to lead us to a promised land.
Was it obvious to you when you met Martin Luther King that this was somebody special?
Yes, very definitely, very definitely. The first time he preached at 12th Baptist Church, September 1951, for a man a year and 7 months younger than I realized that this was going to be a significant African-American and a significant religious leader in the United States. I would have said, this guy is going to end up, I would have thought Riverside Church, University of Chicago, whatever that Rockefeller Church is out there on the campus of University of Chicago, that this guy is going to end up in one of these situations that was white, but is concerned about the health of the United States, concerned about social justice and these concerns. That's what I would imagine. The least that I saw early, that he's going back to Morehouse to be the president. That was the least that I imagined.
Wow.
But I knew the sky was the limit in comparison with other black leaders in the nation.
There's a touch of power. I mean, when you're talking of the Rockefeller establishment in Morehouse, you're talking about big league, not political institutions, but the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very definitely, because one of his mentors was Benjamin Mays, who had his pulse, who had his finger on the pulse of America, his finger on the pulse of education, his finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world of politics. So he had all of these mentors. And I think everywhere he went, he would be looking for these people that had their pulse on national and international concerns and issues. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that they certainly included the concerns of freeing black people from the oppression that they were under and freeing America from the cancer that was destroying it. It's mm-hmm. tragic when a body has a systemic cancer and doesn't realize it, hasn't been diagnosed, hasn't been brought out to them. And I think Dr. King made that diagnosis very, very clear to America.
Mm-hmm.
It really had to do with the issues of love. And in his book, The Trumpet of Conscience, that he speaks about the dependency that everybody has on one another. I think he called it the interdependent structure of all reality, that you can't do without us, we can't do without you, kind of thing. And the nations of the world are dependent on one another, and we need to see this. And he, of course, his ultimate dream was to see a beloved community, a time when in the world we would study war no more. And that was the vision that was burning inside of him even then. And,
Michael Haynes, you've been studying anew and teaching the theology of Martin Luther King Jr. to seminarians. Give us a short course.
Well, I haven't really pursued the theology as deeply as we've looked at really the biographical history of him and his family, his father, all the preachers that from his uncle, all these preachers that were surrounding his family. What is it to have a family with all these preachers on both sides of your family? So we looked at the biography, but then we looked at the preaching and the preaching style. There's a subject very, very common in the black church about preaching in the black tradition. And the black tradition is a little bit different than the white tradition in preaching. And I was born in Boston of parents who were immigrants from a very, very different culture, influenced by the Anglican church and the Moravian church, not by the Black Baptist church. I could certainly practice preaching in the black tradition, but the culture that I was raised up in the theological schools I went to, I would dare say my professors never gave a look at the black tradition in preaching.
So what is the line in theory, in practice, as well as preaching style, between an African American Baptist church and the white evangelical school where you found yourself teaching it? What is the difference?
I think the difference is, if I can try to cull out a phrase used by Martin at one time stated right here in Boston in a speech that the church was supposed to be the headlight, but the church was being the taillight. And I think the key was, if I can draw this analogy, is that oftentimes the so-called white evangelical church, their whole emphasis and goal had to do with heaven and the by and by. And to use the Sammy Davis lingo in his song, meanwhile back at the ranch, they weren't very concerned with how we were getting along back at the ranch. We had a passport to heaven, but we're going to live in hell until we got there. And I think the difference between the black church that tends to be somewhat conservative in its theology is that they are equally concerned. The here and now is extremely important in the black church, as well as eternal life.
That's a start, and it keeps going, though. I bring it up because myself, I'm hugely interested in the African-American version of this Christian revival, which seems to have taken over the country. But it seems to me, just as one observer, that the black church is still a kind of an open secret that has the answers that so many people want. It is a scriptural church, but it's not literal, and it's not fundamentalist. it's a faith-based church, but it's not fantastical and it's not fanatic. It doesn't ask you to sort of suspend your interest in the world. It's not anti-science. It's community-based church, but it's not in the least tribal, which is kind of a trick too. I mean, that to be so rooted in one community's experience and yet to be open in spirit and in fact is important. It's socially activist, but it's not, shall we say, ideological or narrow. It's psychologically open. It's not puritanical. It's moral, but it's not moralistic. I mean, I'm throwing you a softball here, but it seems to me the black churches really show where we're all going to have to go.
I think the answer to that, Chris, is that black people have suffered so intensely in this nation, from the slave episodes to the Civil War to after the Civil War to the reactions and responses after its sons went to war and died and remained coming back to this country. So there is no way that a black minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ can be sensitive, compassionate, concerned, and aware and not realize that there are issues that have to be dealt with in this nation and in this world relating to race, relating to black people. But also, by the same token, that the mission, the goals cannot be attained in isolation, that there has to be partnerships within the body of Christ, within the Christian community, partnership with other existing movements for good in the community. Now, I think there you will find within the black church, you may find as many distinctions and separations as you do within a sector of the white church. There are very, very fundamentalist black churches. They aren't as prevalent as they were, because I think a lot of, well, even the National Baptist Convention, whose historic head, Dr. Jackson, for so long the leader of the Black Baptist Church in America, opposed Dr. King violently. And when they were going to name a Martin Luther King Boulevard, and his church was on it, he changed the address of his church to the adjacent street. That's how much opposed he was to the mission of Dr. King. But I think the sons and daughters that came up in his ministry saw things quite differently.
How did Dr. King's own mission evolve? I mean, the life itself got so compressed in so many issues, including not just rights, but war and peace and theology. What part of Martin Luther King's very short public life, from, say, 1951, as you knew him, till his death in 68, what part surprised you?
One other thing that surprised me was his willingness, his conscious willingness to lay down his life. Greater love hath no man than this, but that he's willing to lay down his life. And Martin could have circumvented. He could have stepped back. He could have left Montgomery quietly, quickly, and taken a post someplace else. He could have got on the phone and called somebody and say, hey, I'd like to be dean in your college, or I'd like to be chaplain in your university. He could have moved and shifted some of this when he was being verbally attacked by black leaders of the more militant stripe. He could have quieted down. He could have said, I've got these children, I've got this wife, I've got to live for them, I've got to provide for them. I think the highest and deepest and best of the love and sacrifice of Christ had permeated this man.
Michael Haynes, what chance did you have over the years, through the 60s especially, the late 60s, to stay in touch with Martin Luther King?
My communication with Martin in latter years was usually when he came to Boston. He usually would make an inquiry about several friends of his that were here. One was a lady by the name of Barbara Wright, and then Mary Powell, who has not received her due in this community. Mary had been part-time secretary for Reverend and Mrs. Hester, and it was Mary that Martin went to because he had been out with taken out a number of girls here, and he'd been to Reverend Hester's house. Reverend Hester had two nieces from North Carolina studying in the graduate schools here at Boston. And so a lot of graduate students would end up in Reverend Hester's house, but he hadn't met any girl that set his heart on fire. And he went to Mary Powell, asking Mary Powell, where are the girls that could set my heart on fire? Essentially is what he said, really. And Mary Powell said it. She was the one that set up the relationship with Coretta, because Coretta was in conservatory of music with her at that time. She was a part-time student in conservatory. But Martin Luther III said that Boston becomes extremely important to him and his brother and his living sister, because it was here that their mother and father met, and it was here that they started their marriage.
You saw Martin Luther King Jr. in the late 60s in Boston. What was the mood in the air that time?
There's a lot of restlessness. There was a lot of restlessness, even here. In fact, one of the questions that he asked me in that last time I spent with him in Boston, he was concerned with how the rank-and-file preachers, black preachers, were responding, because some black preachers felt that he had bitten off more than he could chew in dealing with the issue of the Vietnam War. And his question was, how are the brethren reacting to me? Mm. And in that sense, he was referring to other black ministers. Some people felt that he had stepped into an arena that he shouldn't go in, but many realized that it was an arena that one had to go in. When you realize how many blacks were in the armies and the role that blacks had played in the wars and what war was doing to the world and how war was affecting even the economy and everything else in the world, yes, had to deal with the issue of war. That was one of the last things he discussed with me.
Hmm. What did you tell him?
I responded to him, telling him that the majority of the ministers that I was near were supportive of the stand that he had taken.
Hmm. Was he troubled then about the end?
He wasn't troubled about the end. He was more troubled as to whether or not he was going to gain the support of cross sections of the clergy in taking the new stands he was taking, particularly the stand on the war, as well as the stand on other issues outside of the black people. And a lot of people felt that as long as you deal with the issue of black people, okay. But when you start telling us how to run our country and how to run the world, boy, you've gone too far, sort of thing. Hmm. But I think in his heart, he was becoming very convicted, for this reason, I have come into the world. This is my mission is bigger, broader than just how black people are dealt with an issue here. Although it's primary, there's a broader issue, how we as humans deal with our brothers and sisters, our human brothers and sisters throughout the world. And I think this comes down to his basic concept of a beloved community, where white children and black children will live together in peace and in harmony.
Hmm. Here we are in the Promised Land 40 years later. And so many new issues are there, tremendous issues of inequality in the world, and poverty, and hunger, and still race, but also, above all, peace, domination, empire. Where would that voice be focusing?
I had an interesting thing with the last class that I taught. I asked the students to do a research paper. And just to imagine there were Dr. King. Try to imagine, as difficult as it may be for some of you, try to imagine that you're Dr. King. Take a look at some issue in the here and now that Dr. King did not deal with in his time, and write a paper on how you think he would approach that issue. And out of that, I think one of the top things was the immigration issue. Hmm. That was one of the top ones. And he'd have something to say about HIV and the gay issue. And then another one had to do with the relationship in the Protestant Christian church is still so divided in the United States of America.
How would he address the Christian issue, the evangelical issue, the incredible rise of Christian power, explicit Christian power in this country, but surprisingly around President Bush's base, considered crucial to the war, to a very aggressive American place in the world? Can you channel Martin Luther King Jr. on those themes, in maybe even behind closed doors with fellow ministers?
I would dare say that Martin Luther King Jr., who was concerned about the fact that the race situation in America was creating a cancer that was going to destroy America. And so we have begun to address that, and there's still an awful lot to be done. I think he would be now equally concerned about the cancer that's facing America and making it so despised throughout the world by other nations and other forms of government and other religions that are dominant. And I think this would greatly concern him. I think he might have wanted us to put our brakes on trying to make the Islamic world as the demon all by itself, kind of a thing. So I'm sure he would be dealing with those issues. But one of the things that I've seen that I think would interest Martin, a lot of church groups that were not supportive of Martin in the course of time have become very supportive of his vision and his mission and the movement. A lot of Pentecostal churches that went, black Pentecostal churches that have now taken new stands in community and in society and taken new roles in government and in politics, and which they wouldn't do before. So there are changing things happen, and I think Martin would be pleased with some of them and troubled by others.
He would have to notice a tremendous integration of at least the public symbols of American life in advertising and television and sports and the entertainment in public ways. And he'd have to also remark on a huge growth of here and now prosperity, simply money in the pocket of millions and millions of people who were poor, including black people, in his time.
And I think his response to that would be, unto whom much is given, much is required. I think his response would be that God does not bless you with all of this just to benefit your own self. But you have a community, you have schools, you have education problems, and you need to now share. If you've been brought to this higher level of life, you have a responsibility to go back to those who are still caught below this level and help them to rise.
Michael Haines, you knew him so well. When people, young people who weren't alive in his time, want to know something about, you know, the man on the postage stamp, the man on the holiday calendar, boil it down. Who was this man for them, for you, for now?
I think that my response to some young people is that we would still be living in a hell in America, maybe a different kind of hell below the Mason-Dixon, but there were many years before I moved freely through South Boston. And that's just in recent life. Even as a member of the House of Representatives, I moved cautiously through South Boston. I had a crisis in Charlestown. And it had to do only one reason, race. Had a little incident in West Roxbury. And it, to me, now to see black people walking and living in South Boston and feel in comparative safety, and same in Charlestown, I would tell young people that we couldn't do this before. Dr. King, and not Dr. King alone, I think I would be remiss if I didn't say that Martin over and over again stated the fact that he, in and of himself as a person, was not responsible for all the gains, but there was a whole cadre of people. He had to give some credit to the role that the Stokely Carmichaels and the Black Panthers and all these other groups, SNCC, all these other groups played.
Malcolm
X, definitely. That he would give credit to them for playing a role, and that he didn't do this all by himself. But our young people who sort of have a gimme attitude in life, many of whom think that the world owes them a living, have to be reminded what their forefathers went through and the price that Martin Luther King Jr. paid to lay down his life to bring about this better society that we're living in now. And we pray that neither the Republicans or the Democrats will completely destroy it, but pick up the mission and continue to make America a better place in which to live and make America a better place in the world so that we aren't scorned when we travel and have to worry about carrying our American passports in certain foreign countries of the world.
And what finally would the scriptural or the Christian piece of it be? I saw him quoted the other day saying, in so many words, I'd rather die than hate you. And it is, in the end, about not only turning the other cheek, but loving the one who does you wrong. But in the end, what is the gospel piece of it?
God so loved the world that he gave. And if we love, we would give. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. What did his Son do? His Son gave his life for us. And this is the measure of love that we should be employing in the world. This is the measure of love that was so fundamental to Dr. King. If I can love somebody, if I can help somebody, then my living would not be in vain. And I think he uses Christ's complete sacrifice as a perfect example. He sacrificed seeing his kids go to college. And I think all of them have paid a sacrifice. I've watched them. And I watched Coretta, and her life is over on earth. But I give her credit. She worked very, very, very hard for the establishment of the King holiday. Not just to have a day to honor her husband, but to have a day that records and emphasizes, explains, and teaches the mission that he sought to fulfill in life, so they would continue with that mission. And that becomes very, 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 very personal to me as I think about her. One day I had to be in Washington for something, and I was in Senator Mobley's office and Senator Kennedy's, and then I bumped into Coretta, and she was in the hall waiting for a hearing on the King holiday and asked me to sit with her. I'll never forget that day. The commitment that she made, I'm going to give everything I can to see that this day is established. Never forget that day. I had other things that I had to do. She wanted me to sit there with a moment. She'd tell me how this thing was so heavy on her heart, the importance of the King holiday for the nation, for the world. And then I always revert back to my sitting in junior high school, Timothy Junior High School here in Roxbury, which is the only school I attended that's still standing. Every other school I attended is gone. But sitting there in music appreciation class with my classmate, Salvatore Amato, as we sung Santa Lucia because we're on the verge of Columbus Day holiday and parade, and my friend Johnny McGarry, as we stood on the verge of St. Patty's Day parade that was big, and these were the parades that the black kids had to march, and we didn't have any parade. We didn't have any song. We didn't have any day. We weren't really this symbolic part of America. And if Salvatore Amato was available today, I said, "Now I got a song we can sing. I can sing. I got a holiday we can sing at." But the key thing about it is the holiday is not just for black people, although it gives black people, it gives us a sense of being a part of America, being grafted into the whole of what this nation stands for in its best. I think Martin started off with the Declaration of Independence that we're all equal. We all have these rights. And so we're brought into it. So the holiday, the King holiday now to me, gives me a sense of being a real integral part of America. And with that reality comes the responsibility of trying to help everybody else become a real integral part of America and taking down those barriers and those blocks that block anybody from becoming a real part of America. That's the challenge. I think one of the songs that he had sung at his funeral that was very, very, very personal to him, "I Trust in God Wherever I May Be." And that was a song that was very, very deep and very, very meaningful to him.
Do you remember the words?
"I trust in God wherever I may be, upon the land or on the rolling sea. But come what may, from day to day, my Heavenly Father watches over me. I trust in God, I know He cares for me, upon the land or on the rolling sea. Though come what may, from day to day, my Heavenly Father watches over me." One of his favorites. Yeah. So he had this devout faith in God. And Jesus was very, very real to him, and he trusted he placed the unknown future in God's hand. And as he said on that night, longevity had its place, and here's a man that knew he was going to die, and longevity has a place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and he's allowed me to go over, and I've seen the promise, and I was listening to him the other day doing it. I don't know how long it took him to say the word "seen." he just took it, I've seen. I mean, it took so long. I said, and I was saying to myself, when I watched it, I said, I wonder what he was feeling and thinking at that moment, not realizing that his own life had gone down to not years, not months, not weeks, not days. His life had gone down to minutes. That he was on a countdown, and he stood there, and it seemed like he would never stop saying, and I've seen the promised land. And I wonder what visions he had and what sense he had, you know, and never know that walking back that night was going to be the end of the journey.
Astonishing. You say it so well. I watched that YouTube a dozen times, even in the last week, and I look at his face. I'm thinking, what is he going through? This something very, very driven, very resolute, very prepared, very tough, very angry.
Yes.
He jumps off that podium. When he says the last word, I'm out of here. I got important business. I don't know. Any more ways to read that video?
Yeah.
And of course, he's there are no notes here. There's no, this is, he's improvising in a way. He's searching.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, you know, after you're concentrating on these things, here's a guy that has spent much of his graduate school life looking for a way of righteousness and truth to deal with the curse and sin of discrimination and war. And he's looking at it in his trip to India. I remember him saying, and he writes in a number, how important it was, his trip to India. After reading and studying Mahatma Gandhi over and over again, to be able to go to India. And then willingly facing that. And I've come clearly to that conclusion. Whatever any theologian, whatever they be, evangelical, Muslim, Nation of Islam, atheist, whatever anybody says, I myself am strongly convicted that God had placed his hands on this man's life for the particular reason of saving America from a civil war. A civil war. I heard somebody say the other day, I don't know who it was, that Martin Luther King Jr. was the general that fought the last battle of the Civil War. And I said, that's it.
Keep doing it in your own extraordinary style. Michael Haynes, it's a pleasure to hear you on Open Source.